Now, the International Monetary Fund recently announced its growth projections for sub-Saharan Africa, as the institution expects growth to recover to 3.1% in 2018, this coming from 2.7% in 2017. Question is, how achievable is this figure amid global headwinds and policy uncertainty across much of sub-Saharan Africa? Dr. Martin Davis, the Managing Director of Emerging Markets and Africa, Deloitte, joins me now for more on this. Many thanks for making time to speak to us, Dr. Davis. Let's start with this idea of restructuring much of the economic ecosystem across Africa. Tell me, what does this mean for markets and businesses looking to invest across the region?
Yes, thank you. Well, undoubtedly, 2019 will be an interesting year for the continent, with arguably the two bookends of sub-Saharan Africa, Nigeria and South Africa. Both have general elections, and we're hoping that with the sort of arguably the two biggest economies in the region, with some new political impetus, hopefully, and certainly some certainty, will provide a renewed foundation for growth. And when we're looking at, you know, the region, I think we have to look at Nigeria, South Africa, and Kenya first and foremost as the primary contributors to growth, not just their own domestic economies, of course, but each acts as almost a regional sort of engine room for neighboring countries. So I think post sort of, let's say, arguably mid-year 2019, we hopefully will have some increased tailwinds domestically to start to strive, towards more rapid growth, structural reform, and most importantly, implementation going forward. You refer also to the perhaps tension in the global macro, which is somewhat disabling. Undoubtedly, countries are even more competitive than ever for foreign direct investment, and this will certainly hit Africa arguably negatively come 2019. So, but again, there's many factors to consider here. There's commodity prices, there's the oil price, of course, for West Africa, which is certainly ticking upwards nicely for petro states in recent months. So Africa, to conclude, Africa's been through a very tough 4 years, some of it self-inflicted, some of it just commodity price reduction. And I think there's some, on balance, there's more tailwinds than headwinds come 2019.
I think one thing that really strikes me is the fact that if we do look at growth projections right now as an aggregate figure for sub-Saharan Africa, including the two powerhouses that you've mentioned, Nigeria and South Africa, the growth projections are 3.1. But if we are to put out Nigeria and South Africa, that growth projection will go up to 4.6%. This is according to the latest IMF Article 4s. And this leaves me wondering, is it time for investors to look at the continent away from this aggregate figure and just look at the likes of Cote d'Ivoire, Ethiopia, Kenya, like you've mentioned? Some of these numbers are astronomical. Rwanda, then, there too.
I think you're entirely correct. We need to have a lot more granular approach to what is a very wide geography and a very heterogeneous region. So what does the figure really mean when you're including oil exporting states and oil importing states when the interests are entirely different and divergent? For example, the growth trajectory of many of these West African countries, Nigeria, Angola, arguably amongst others, entirely dependent on the oil price, and predicting that is a bit of a mug's game. So I think at best a regional, sub-regional level, certainly not a pan-African one. I think these numbers arguably are A, superficial, and B, perhaps a pointless exercise in trying to predict what is a very diverse region and trying to come to some sort of coherent figure. So, and I think increasingly those countries you mentioned, Cote d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, Rwanda, certainly Ethiopia, these countries should not be painted with the same brush as the region. These are countries differentiating themselves through good reform, through good economic management, and becoming far more functional states. They should be rewarded by capital rather than being sort of arguably part of the same regional brush of other countries, perhaps that are doing far less to attract capital and interest.
Rewarded by capital. That's a very interesting line. Let's move on to private capital. Now, this, in your arguments, should be the key driver come at least to the near to the midterm. But we are seeing private capital in many of the emerging frontier countries just almost non-existent. Take, for instance, Tanzania, Vodacom, the IPO that happened, same as MTN Ghana's IPO. These were massively undersubscribed, by local investors. Give me a sense of what this entails going forward.
Well, I think let's just differentiate private capital here. I think we've heard of resource nationalism. Some countries even have, you know, South Africa case in point, airline nationalism. Let's not have stock exchange nationalism. The continent has far too many countries for every country to think they deserve or should have a stock exchange. The size of the economy, the size of the private sectors are just too small. So I think a realization and a consolidation of regional exchanges is stating the obvious. Even Nigeria's stock exchange arguably is not viable, tiny in comparison to what you see in South Africa in terms of flows. So I'd rather look at private capital, which could and should be more a real driver of private sector activity. Talking venture capital here, rather than in private equity, rather than just looking at sort of failed IPOs or you know, disappointing IPOs on stock exchanges that don't really have a right to exist in terms of a market right to exist. So I think venture capital increasingly is how do we get more energetic venture capital from global funds, from local funds into the newer economies, new emerging sectors of Africa, i.e. startup companies or companies looking to scale domestically or across borders through venture capital. I'm more of a proponent than that than I certainly would be of politically forced local IPOs on stock exchanges that arguably are non-viable to begin with.
Now, going forward, there's a big, well, arguably the deal of the century on the continent happens to be the Africa continent or free trade area. Of course, the man at the Africa Union right now, His Excellency Paul Kagame of Rwanda, pushing for integration. And we're looking at over $1 trillion. If this actually comes together as a free trade area, that my biggest issue here for me, and you might actually correct me, is ratification and making this work as opposed to having it become another Malabo declaration or a Yamoussoukro decision where some of these huge, massive deals with a lot of potential are just signed and put on top of a cupboard somewhere and just collect dust. Going forward, how massive is this and what is the potential for this for uplifting aggregate growth across the region?
No, well, look at it firstly from Kigali's perspective and Paul Kagame. This is a landlocked country, very progressive economically, and really needs to integrate to build economies of scale and plug its economy, its own domestic economy, into the region. So undoubtedly, it's in Rwanda's, you know, national interest to pursue a Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement. And I think we should rather be pursuing, arguably, it makes for good marketing. It's a good wide, you know, broad brush sort of a marketing initiative. I just think practically it, and experience this firsthand, practically at border posts, this agreement means very little. We should rather be pursuing very proactive three things. Sub-regional integration through such agreements. I think that's first point. Secondly is better cross-border infrastructure. And thirdly, and most importantly, is supporting that infrastructure, hard infrastructure, is border posts that are functioning, are highly functional, efficient, time-saving, and non-corrupt. Now, that ain't going to be changed by an agreement signed in Addis. That's up to sovereign national governments to fix. And they need the will and the wherewithal to make it happen. So rather than putting the sort of a very well-intended Africa-Continental Free Trade Agreement in place, it comes down to world domestic governments, African governments, like Rwanda, be doing the right thing and getting their own border posts up to speed, functioning, and allowing for the flows of goods and labor across borders and truly then integrating Africa. I don't think it's more about practical implementation than it is about politicians with dysfunctional states at times signing policy papers in Addis.
Without a doubt. Finally, Dr. Davies, let's talk about fiscal space. Now, the IMF has also warned very, very massively on the lack of fiscal space across much of sub-Saharan Africa. Of course, this does correlate with the global headwinds, relatively slower growth across the region, not forgetting a commodities crunch over the past 2-3 years. One thing that's very striking is many countries have actually turned towards Eurobonds and debt that is foreign currency denominated, which is scary to say the least. Give me a sense of 2019 to 2020. Do you see debt servicing costs actually biting? We've already seen some countries have, what, 20%, over 20% of their tax receipts going towards just servicing foreign debt. Where do you stand on this one?
Well, this is, as you correctly say or tee it up, it's deeply problematic. In countries like Zambia, amongst others, and Kenya, arguably, don't have that fiscal headroom room to maneuver. We have, in many cases, South Africa case in point, low to no growth economies with significantly high levels of debt we did 10 years ago. So it just talks about the inability. Normally, a country would take on debt to create economically enabling infrastructure or stimulus spend. So clearly, the spend has not been stimulating of growth and is not created by and large economically enabling infrastructure. So this talks to monies that have been siphoned off at times, or more politely, have been very inefficiently spent, i.e. the capital has not been qualitative, has not been productively allocated and spent. Why? Because ultimately private capital is a lot more qualitative and sustainable than public capital. And that, I think, is the story here for 2019. The concern, you mentioned the word macro again, is how able are certain African states to weather a crisis globally, potentially, or at the very least a rapid slowdown, which would negatively impact their own economies, perhaps through reduced rents or revenues from commodity prices, a drying up or reduction in foreign direct investment, etc. So, again, what I think 2019 will be an inflection point going forward for many countries, political economies that are going to be forced, because of debt, to have to structurally reform once again. This is problematic, and again, knocks these companies' development trajectories back again by a number of years. We thought we'd gotten over this in countries like Ghana's case, many others perhaps, who should have learned better, but the mistakes have not been at times observed by neighboring African countries.
Dr. Davies, always good to have you on the show. That was Dr. Martin Davies, who's the Managing Director of Emerging Markets and Africa at Deloitte, just giving us a sense of what 2019 holds and the midterm, given the fact that we are seeing some global headwinds. China is in there with that fight, well, a trade fight, should we say, with the United States of America. This all coming on the back of a relative recovery in oil prices.